From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I thought this week I'd cover a couple of topics that were important articles in this week's journals. I'm going to start with some of the key findings from a wonderful review in JACC having to do with catheter ablation of ventricular tachycardia. And then I'll finish with a really interesting article that came out this week looking at measuring high-sensitivity troponin after non-cardiac surgery. Let's start with catheter ablation for ventricular tachycardia. This was a two-part review article that was published in JACC by Ducapati and colleagues. It's a really great review. And I want to give you just a few key points to remember about ventricular tachycardia catheter ablation. We'll start with the thought about catheter ablation in patients who appear to have a structurally normal heart. Obviously, the first point is that VTAC is uncommon in patients who have structurally normal hearts. Isolated premature ventricular beats are far more typical. Among patients who have this syndrome, the most common site for ventricular arrhythmias in patients like this is either the right or left ventricular outflow tract. The optimal management for patients who have outflow tract PVCs or VT really depends on several important risk factors. These include presence of symptoms related to the arrhythmia, is there underlying heart disease, or what is the risk of developing cardiomyopathy? Pharmacologic therapy with beta blockers is typically used first line in patients who have symptomatic PVCs in the structurally normal heart. Non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers are also an option, particularly in patients who for some reason can't tolerate or won't take beta blockers. Catheter ablation should be offered to medication-resistant or medication-intolerant patients. And certainly, a patient who has a cardiomyopathy and frequent PVCs, that is more than 10% of beats, should be considered strongly for catheter ablation because not infrequently the left ventricular function will improve, even in the presence of other structural heart disease. Papillary muscle ventricular arrhythmias in a structurally normal heart makes up about 5 to 12% of all idiopathic ventricular arrhythmias. And this often presents as PVCs, but occasionally can also be seen as non-sustained or even sustained VT. Idiopathic left ventricular VT in the structurally normal heart, which is also called fascicular VT, constitutes about 10 to 20% of all idiopathic ventricular tachycardias. In the absence of structural heart disease, catheter ablation can be performed for both symptomatic and or frequent PVCs or idiopathic LVVT, either as a first-line treatment or for arrhythmias that have been refractory to medical treatment. In this category of patients, that is structurally normal heart, the risk of sudden cardiac death is low, so that these idiopathic tachycardias, the treatments very frequently will lead to a sudden death, unless there's a patient who also develops polymorphic VT or ventricular fibrillation. Then, of course, that's a different matter. So in patients with structurally normal hearts, the outcomes of catheter ablation for the above indications, those that we talked about before, are usually quite good. And I think earlier referral for potentially curative treatment is certainly an important notion to consider. The second part of this review looked at the use of catheter ablation in the far more common circumstance, and that is for ventricular tachycardia in patients who have structural heart disease. So clearly, VT that occurs in patients with structural heart disease carries a much higher risk for sudden cardiac death, and implantable cardioverter defibrillators, ICDs, are the mainstay of therapy. Beta blockers, if they're not contraindicated, are recommended as they reduce mortality following VT and VF, particularly in patients with heart failure, or reduced left ventricular function. Catheter ablation can be used as an adjunctive therapy to treat or prevent repetitive ICD firing, especially when antiarrhythmic drugs are either ineffective or due to side effects are not desired. Catheter ablation is especially indicated for sustained monomorphic VT that recurs in spite of antiarrhythmic drugs or when drugs are not tolerated. Also, for the control of incessant sustained monomorphic VT or VT storm that is not due to a transient reversible cause. Also, bundle branch reentrant or interfascicular VT. Patients who have frequent PVCs in the setting of structurally abnormal heart. Non-sustained or sustained VT in the setting of ventricular dysfunction. And recurrent sustained polymorphic VT and VF that is refractory to antiarrhythmic therapy. These are all indications for catheter ablation. It also should be considered for patients with sustained monomorphic VT despite therapy with class 1 or class 3 antiarrhythmic drugs, or as an alternative to amiodarone in patients with prior MI and an LVEF greater than 30%. Also, VT ablation could be considered as an alternative to antiarrhythmic drugs for hemodynamically tolerated sustained monomorphic VT due to prior MI and an EF greater than 35%. In certain patients, frequent premature ventricular contractions or VT can cause tachycardiomyopathy. And in these kinds of patients, particularly if they have a borderline EF, ablation might be considered before ICD implantation. So that if you get a patient who's got an EF 30-35% and a heavy burden of PVCs, after catheter ablation, that left ventricular function may recover to 40-50%, and in such patients, this may obviate the need for the implantation of an ICD. Clearly, the approach to catheter ablation of VT and structural heart disease involves characterization of the target arrhythmias, delineation of the arrhythmic substrate, often with MRI, and then radiofrequency ablation of the targeted tissue. Clearly, catheter ablation of ventricular tachycardia in patients with structural heart disease can reduce the incidence of recurrent arrhythmias and shocks, and this is, of course, a major indication for their therapy. The risk of catheter ablation is acceptable, but certainly patients who present with VT storm, who have advanced heart failure, particularly those with severely reduced LV function and other comorbidities, they certainly are at risk for procedure-related hemodynamic decompensation, and some of these individuals benefit from percutaneous hemodynamic support during the procedure. And I think we'll see in the future technologic advances in mapping, in defining the substrate better with imaging, and hopefully also with the ablation techniques themselves. So I thought these two articles were really very useful, giving us some key points that we want to remember as they relate to application of catheter ablation for ventricular tachycardia in both patients with structurally normal heart and patients who have abnormal substrates. Let me then switch gears and finish in the area of perioperative myocardial injury. This is a study published just this week in Circulation. It was titled Perioperative Myocardial Injury After Non-Cardiac Surgery, Incidence, Mortality, and Characterization. And I've had a longstanding interest in perioperative MI and perioperative risk stratification. So this article sort of hit me in my sweet spot, I suppose. The investigators performed a prospective study. They looked at patients having non-cardiac surgery who had a planned postoperative stay for at least a day and were considered to be at increased risk for a cardiovascular outcome. They all had systemic screening measurement using serial measurements of high-sensitivity cardiac troponin. Postoperative MI was defined as an absolute increase in the high-sensitivity C troponin to greater than 14 nanograms per liter from pre-op to post-operative measurement. And then mortality was looked at, comparing the patients who had elevation of troponin versus not, and also whether they had other clinical criteria of ischemia or MI, including symptoms, new ECG changes, or imaging evidence of loss of viable myocardium. So the study looked at over 2,000 patients. 42% were female, the median age 74 years. A post-op MI was defined by high-sensitivity troponin as being present in 16%. That is 397 patients. Typical chest pain only was seen in 24 of these individuals, or 6% of that group. And ischemic symptoms of any kind were just seen in 72 of the 397, or 18%. The investigators did show that crude 30-day mortality was 8.9% in patients who had evidence of troponin release versus 1.5% in those who did not. And in multivariate analysis, there was an independent hazard ratio of about 2.7 for 30-day mortality. And this was maintained at 1 year, where the hazard ratio approached 3. Interestingly, the 30-day mortality was comparable among patients who had a postoperative MI just by troponin release versus those who had additional clinical evidence of myocardial ischemia or infarction. And so the authors concluded that postoperative MI by high-sensitivity troponin can be detected, and it's associated with a substantial both 30-day and 1-year mortality. I think the interesting part of this is that what do we do with the information? Over the last 30 years, we've shown that we can identify preoperative risk with various techniques, including stress testing, et cetera. And yet the response to the abnormality hasn't really paid off. We've gone through stages of trying to identify and then treat fixed coronary disease with angioplasty and bypass. In stable patients, that has not panned out. We've seen that beta blockers may reduce perioperative myocardial infarction, but in the wrong patients, they can actually increase the risk of both cardiac and non-cardiac death. And we think statins probably lower perioperative myocardial injury in patients at risk or with known coronary disease. But beyond statins, we don't have a lot to offer. And so papers like this one, which are very interesting in showing the potential power of biomarkers to predict risk, are still begging in terms of what do we do? What is the response in these individuals? And we really need both imaging and biomarker studies like this one to be coupled with therapy before we really are going to ascertain how we should change our practice according to new measurement techniques that are coming along. So I thought it was an interesting paper, and you're going to see much more in the biomarker space in the months and years ahead, and I'm sure we'll be having an ongoing dialogue. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org, and all of this information can be found on the American College of Cardiology's website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts, and until next week, thanks for listening.